Welcome to episode 2 of the Emergency Physician Advocates, Medical Legal Issues in Emergency Medicine, a production of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine. AAEM is a nonprofit professional association of over 7,000 emergency physicians committed to board certification and democratic group practice. This month's podcast features Dr. Joseph Wood, Vice Chair of Emergency Medicine at Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale and past president of AAEM.
This is Dr. Joseph Wood. I'm a practicing emergency physician. I also have a law degree. I've taught law school for 10 years in Illinois, and I'm a member of the Illinois and the Arizona Bar. Today I'm going to speak to you about contract basics, and by that I mean employment contracts that'll be of interest to most emergency physicians. Being a good lawyer, I need to get a disclaimer out. This podcast is intended purely for education. It doesn't establish a client-attorney relationship with me or any of the listeners, just as if I was giving a podcast on a cardiology topic would not establish a patient-physician relationship. I think you'll enjoy the podcast. It'll give you some information that you can use going forward, and it'll make you a better consumer when you hire your own attorney to get legal advice. I'm going to start with what might sound like a rhetorical question, but there's a reason for it. What are the chances you will encounter an important legal issue in your career? And I think the answer is quite high. I read a statistic once that said the average emergency physician spends more time in a courtroom than the average professional criminal. We get called into court quite often for assault and battery, rape, and various things that we see in the ER. But almost surely, at some point in your career, you're going to have some type of dispute with your employer. And when you have the dispute, you're going to have to decide either to walk away or to somehow settle it amicably or litigate it. And what path you choose is highly dependent on what the baseline contract says. In other words, what rights you both have agreed to. So if you listen to this podcast, it's at least going to alert you to some key contract issues that will impact your career and probably your financial future. And I'll give you some practical advice about how to negotiate key terms in the contract. One other thing to point out, I've had physicians ask me to review their contract with the admonition, I want you to look this over and make sure it's risk-free. Now, there is no such thing. Contracts are all about assigning risk. The only way I can make your contract risk-free is to put all the risk on the other party, and I don't think your future employer would tolerate that. All right, let's jump in and look at some key terms. The first one is almost starting at the back end, and that is termination. Every relationship is going to have to contemplate some termination. How will the relationship end? There's two ways your contract will end. Either you'll terminate it or your employer will. If your employer decides to terminate it, the employer will either terminate for cause or without cause. And frankly, the most common way is simply without cause. A for-cause termination means you've done something wrong. You have materially breached the contract, and the employer has the right to terminate the contract because of your breach. And your contract will probably have some provision for this. The one thing I would watch for is be sure it's highly specific. For-cause terminations usually put a little bit of a red flag on you. On the other hand, because for-cause terminations are difficult, most contracts allow the employer to terminate for no cause whatsoever, simply with 90 days notice or 120 days notice. So even if you think you have a 5-year contract, it probably is only a 90-day contract that starts fresh every day. When you review your contract and look at the for-cause termination clause, be sure that it's highly specific. It should be for some very egregious behavior, and there should be an opportunity for you to cure. So if the employer thinks that you have done something wrong and materially breached the contract should require the employer to notify you of the breach and give you time to cure it. And again, it should be something that would clearly prohibit you from continuing on in the contract. An example would be loss of your medical license, or loss of your privileges, or loss of the right to bill Medicare. And again, there should be an opportunity to cure. The vast majority of physicians that are terminated by their employer are terminated without cause. This simply allows either party to terminate by giving notice. Generally, this is 90 days, could be as long as 120 days. I've seen some as far out as 6 months. The employers like this because they don't have to go through the unseemly process of terminating somebody for cause. Physicians will feel a lack of security with these clauses, but remember, it also gives you the right to terminate. So if you sign a five-year contract and then 6 months later get offered your dream job, it gives you a chance to get out of the contract. Hospitals usually will insist on the ability to terminate a physician without cause after they give appropriate notice. The reason is hospitals consider the emergency department their business. Patients come to the hospital ER identifying with the hospital, not with individual physicians. And like any other businessman, they feel the need to control who's delivering the services. Now, intertwined with the idea of termination of your employment contract, we have to deal with your medical staff privileges. All physicians on the medical staff, even emergency physicians, have to be granted privileges by the hospital board of directors. The JCHO and the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act of 1986 mandates that medical staff members be given due process if any adverse action is taken on their clinical privileges. And for that reason, the hospital has to deal with this requirement and generally will ask you in your contract to waive your right of due process should they terminate your employment. They'll simply say, if your employment is terminated, you automatically resign your medical staff privileges and waive any right of due process. Hospitals are unlikely to give in on this point. And the reason is they feel they need the ability to make a clean sweep of the physicians working in the department if they bring in a new group. You can imagine the problem they would have if they went from one contract group to another, but three or four of the doctors working for the previous group announced that they were going to continue to work in the emergency department and would bill patients on their own. Sounds a little far-fetched, but there are cases where this has actually happened and created quite a problem for the hospital. Unfortunately, your waiver of your due process rights, coupled with the ability of the hospital to terminate you without any cause whatsoever, leaves you with very little job security. Many physicians realize that this lack of job security has created some dissatisfaction for a lot of emergency physicians. They feel lack of control and lack of ability to speak out on quality issues. This has led to some burnout, both due to internal and external checking out. The reality is, though, that hospitals are unlikely to give on this, and the current legal landscape makes it hard to negotiate this away. One suggestion I've given some physicians is to add language to the contract as follows, quote, physician cannot be terminated for advocating on behalf of patient care or quality issues, close quote. Essentially, when you negotiate your contract, rather than asking the hospital or the group to take out language asking you to waive your right of due process or saying you can be terminated without cause, you agree to it, but you add this language in which they agree not to terminate you as retaliation for advocating on a quality issue or advocating on behalf of a patient. Next key phrase in your contract are non-compete clauses. There are a variety of non-compete clauses. Some will keep you from working for a competitor. Others keep you from stealing the contract from the contract group or the democratic group you're working for. Some will mention that you can't steal their trade secrets. Some are so broad that they keep you from providing services to the hospital even through a succeeding contract group. Now, surprisingly, a lot of physicians have commented to me that they don't think these are enforceable. But my own research of the law shows that most states will enforce these. There are a few states that by statute and a few states by common law where these non-competition clauses have been found unenforceable as against public policy. But again, the majority of states will enforce these if they are deemed to be reasonable. So if you sign a contract with a non-competition clause, you should do so with the assumption that it will be enforced. Now, I have found that these can usually be softened by some negotiation. And again, there's a strategy to negotiating this. If you go to the contract group or your employer and argue about various non-competition clauses, you're going to raise a little bit of a red flag. They will understandably think you're interested somehow in taking the contract away. What I have found to be workable is to agree to the language that's there, but ask them to add the following phrase, quote, notwithstanding any other language in this agreement, if the contract group loses the contract to provide staffing in the hospital ED through no fault of the physician, she shall retain the right to practice in the hospital ED, end quote. In essence, what you're saying is you're agreeing to a non-competition clause, but if the contracting group loses the contract and it's not your fault, you don't have to pick up and move. You're free to work for the succeeding group. And I've been surprised even with some national contract groups, they've accepted that language. The next key area in your employment contract is whether or not you'll be an employee or an independent contractor. 10 years ago, the majority of emergency physicians provided services as independent contractors. There definitely are advantages to this. A big one is the tax deductions you can take for business expenses. Also, you can individualize your benefit plan. You can imagine if you have a group of 10 or 12 doctors of various ages, some of the older physicians would like to put away the maximum amount into retirement programs, while the younger doctors want to put more money into their pockets because they have immediate expenses. If everyone worked as an independent contractor, each person can individualize their benefit plans and retirement plans. The advantages of being an employee are, first of all, there's just less administrative hassle. You don't have to file a separate tax return for an LLC or an S corporation. You don't have administrative expenses and accounting expenses you might have as an independent contractor. A big one, however, in my opinion, is the IRS seems to favor employee status for emergency physicians. This shouldn't be surprising to anyone if you realize one of the reasons people wanted to be independent contractors is their increased ability to take business deductions. The IRS is aware of that also. The IRS also, I think, feels it's easier to control and be certain of what your actual income is if you are an employee. And one last reason I think employee status is beneficial to an emergency physician is the vicarious liability of the employer. Most emergency physicians carry malpractice policies of $1 million to $3 million. That means that for any one event, the most your insurer will pay is $1 million. If it's $1 million, $3 million, they cap their total output for the year at $3 million. But again, only $1 million on any one claim. You can imagine if you had a very high income earner, have a misdiagnosis such as an MI, that the award could be significantly over $1 million. If you're employed by a hospital or a group with deep pockets, the plaintiff can go after not only you and collect your $1 million insurance policy, but can easily go after the employer. If you're an independent contractor, that's more difficult. To the extent the plaintiff has no one else to go after, they may start going after your personal assets. The problem with being an independent contractor is, frankly, the IRS. The IRS can come in and retroactively recharacterize your relationship as one of employment, not that of contractor / independent contractor. The net effect of the IRS recharacterizing your relationship as that of an employee is you're going to owe some back taxes. They're basically going to disallow your earlier deductions. They're going to disallow contributions you made to your retirement plan, and they're going to add in back taxes, penalties, and interest. I have seen firsthand emergency physicians that underwent such an audit and owed over $250,000 to the IRS because of this recharacterization. If you're going to be an independent contractor, understand that the IRS will look at who really is controlling your behavior. There's a 23-point common law test. We're not going to go over all 23 points, but a lot of it's common sense. If you hire a plumber to come over and fix a problem, you agree with him when he's going to come over. He brings his own tools, and you certainly don't supervise him or tell him how to do it. You tell him what you want done, and how he accomplishes that task is up to him. Contrast that with emergency physicians. You may go to work for a hospital. You're going to have a name badge with a hospital name on it. You're going to be subject to being placed on a schedule, and they're going to provide you with the tools of the trade. There's also very detailed manuals that outline how you're supposed to do your job. For that reason, the IRS feels emergency physicians look more like employees than independent contractors. Now, there are some safe harbors. You can look at IRS Section 503 that describes safe harbors, but it's a little bit tricky, and anyone that decides to practice as an independent contractor should review this decision with their attorney. The last key contract clause I want to review, I think, is the most important, and that is the medical malpractice insurance. The June 2005 edition of Emergency Medicine News carried the following headline: Fi America strands physicians with no malpractice coverage. There were approximately 70 physicians who faced the problem of having malpractice claims filed against them, but facing the risk that the self-insurance pool that Fi America had set up would not be adequate to deal with all 70 claims. There are many parts of your contract that at times, while you don't like it, you may say you'll accept it because you really want to live in that town or you really like working at that hospital. One area of your contract that you just can't compromise or take chances is your medical malpractice insurance. You won't sleep well at night if you don't have decent coverage. So let me get into some of the basics. There's basically two types of policies: a claims-made policy or an occurrence policy. If you have a claims-made policy, at some point you're going to have to deal with what's called tail coverage, and I'll explain what that is. And then the other thing you have to think about are policy limits. Kind of the general around the country is what we call a $1 million, $3 million policy. Wherever you see two numbers, the first number always caps the amount the insurance company has to pay on any single claim. The second number caps the amount the insurance company will pay on your behalf for all claims made against you in any 1 year. So again, a $1 million / $3 million policy would cap the amount they're going to pay on any one claim at $1 million. And cap the amount they pay cumulatively for any year at $3 million. Occurrence insurance will cover you for any liability, any negligent act that occurred while the policy was in effect. Even if you later cancel that insurance, move, and start up with a new insurance company, if there's a claim filed against you for a negligent act that occurred while the policy was in force, that insurance company will indemnify you. Therefore, there's no need for what we call tail coverage. Unfortunately, this is the minority of policies, and it's not available in some areas. The more common arrangement is a claims-made insurance policy. Claims-made policies will cover a physician only if the alleged negligence and the claim is filed while the policy is in force. So if the physician commits a negligent act and a year later takes up with a new insurance company, and shortly after that a claim is filed related to that negligent act, his previous insurance carrier will not cover him or indemnify him unless he has purchased what's called a tail. Now, what the tail does is it's an agreement between you and your insurance company that you no longer will be covered by them for any new acts, but that they will indemnify you against any claim that comes down the road if it's related to a negligent act while their coverage was in force. Now, generally, the tail coverage will cost you 1.5 times whatever your last year's premium was. So if you're paying $50,000 a year for malpractice insurance and you decide to move to another job and you have to purchase the tail agreement, that would cost you $75,000. And generally, the insurance companies give you a fairly short time limit to make the decision as to whether or not you're going to purchase the tail. The kicker is I've seen many contracts that state the employer will provide medical malpractice insurance and yet doesn't even specify if it'll be occurrence or claims made. And I've seen many other contracts that state it's claims made, but they don't specify whether the employer or the physician will be responsible for paying the tail. And finally, I want to alert you, if the employer is responsible for paying the tail, you have to ask yourself how secure that promise is. An example of this is as follows. I worked with some physicians who were employed by a small contract group, basically owned by one contract holder, for a number of years. Their contract stated that the contracting group would purchase tail insurance when the contract was terminated. They provided services to a hospital for 5 years. The hospital subsequently terminated the contract, but the group leader was faced with purchasing tail coverage for 10 physicians. At $75,000 per physician, this was quite a bill for the CMG owner. And in fact, rather than pay it, the CMG dissolved, going out of business. Period. I assume the CMG owner took whatever assets were left in the corporation, but the physicians did not have the tail premium paid on their behalf. Now remember, the insurance company doesn't care why it's not being paid or who was supposed to pay it. That's none of their business. What they do care about is the tail going to be purchased, and will it be purchased in the 30-day window that's being offered? So the physicians in this individual instance that I just mentioned had a very daunting decision on whether or not to purchase the tail with their own money and then try to go after the group leader who had dissolved the corporation, or would they not buy the tail and simply take the risk? From my point of view, that's too much risk to take. What we've done is covered what I consider 4 key contract clauses: termination, malpractice insurance, whether or not you should be an employee or an independent contractor, and non-compete clauses. And this has not been an exhaustive discussion, but at least it's a start. It's a primer. In closing, a lot of people have asked me, do I need a lawyer to help me with this contract? Now, I am a lawyer, so obviously my biases are yes, but I'd point out the following. You don't want your lawyer to be antagonistic. You don't want your lawyer even to negotiate the contract for you. That's too expensive. They're going to charge you quite a bit per hour. You're going to know more about whether or not it's a good job, what the pay is like, but you need a lawyer to help you finalize the contract. Remember, the hospital or the group you're working for, they use a lawyer. There's no reason you shouldn't. It won't be considered antagonistic because they expect you to. They might even be raising their eyebrows if you don't. Overall, they're going to be more comfortable if you make an informed choice when you sign on the bottom line. If you use a lawyer, this is a good way sometimes of avoiding confrontation. There may be areas of the contract that you're concerned with, but when you negotiate, you can play down your concerns and simply say your lawyer is concerned about this. You could make the lawyer the bad guy. And finally, if something goes wrong in the contract, if you've had a lawyer review it and you've been very specific with the lawyer about your concerns, such as do you have adequate medical malpractice insurance, that gives you somebody else to go after yourself if things fall through the cracks, as they did for the physicians involved in the Fi America bankruptcy. On future podcasts, we're going to go into greater detail about termination, both with and without cause. We'll also discuss principles of asset protection, as a lot of physicians have concerns about this and wonder at times how they structure their contract could be a factor in protecting their assets. Thanks for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the American Academy of Emergency Medicine. For more information about AAEM, please visit our website, www.aaem.org. While you are there, be sure to check out the AAEM blog, part of AAEM Connect, where you can leave comments and engage in a conversation around the issues discussed in this podcast. Join us again next month. Dr. Larry Weiss, past president of AAEM, will discuss restrictive covenants in emergency physician contracts.